Welcome to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And, of course, along with your call, some topics to talk over, Zorba.
Yes. Before you exercise, do you stretch? Well, I certainly do. Well, is it good for you? Will it improve your performance or not? Some very interesting, provocative data on this that may surprise you.
Mm-hmm.
And live music. Does it charm your premature? Does it charm your baby? Is it something that we should be doing more of when our children are young?
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about it. And our recipe?
Herb and almond crackers. A cracker recipe. I don't remember when we had a cracker recipe.
I don't either.
Do you?
We have one now.
Yes, we do. Yes,
800-462-7413, toll free. And to the phones now, Zorba, a listener with us in Sumner, Illinois. Hi.
Hello. How are you two today?
Fine. How can we help?
I have a question for Dr. Zorba. My question is this. Whenever it comes to cookware that have nonstick coating, is it beneficial for people to use plastic utensils in that to keep from chipping the surface off? And if people do use metal within those and that chips off into the food, is that a health issue?
You know, this has been a question that's been addressed basically since Teflon was invented back in the 50s when the astronauts were going – went into the atmosphere and came down, and basically Teflon was used to coat the capsule that went into the water and then was started to be used in cooking. And the government has done lots and lots of research on this because Teflon-coated pans are really common. In other words, they are the common – most common pans that are really out today, and they make a huge difference. And they found that basically it's inert. Now, let's look at the other side. The other side says that Teflon really isn't inert and it may be causing problems. Well, then you enter the problems that we have since Teflon came in. Increase in autism, increase in certain types of cancers like colon cancer that we don't have any explanation for. And then everyone wonders, well, is it due to some toxin in the environment? Definitely a possibility. I certainly think it may be. So we may blame insecticides on one hand or air pollution, and then we may blame Teflon. And so, you know, with all that in mind, my recommendation to people is, number one, if you're going to use Teflon, follow the instructions and use plastic utensils so you're not going to get it in your food. And if you're worried about Teflon, don't use it and use some old-fashioned pans. And I entertain a lot in my house. I have a lot of people over, and I've got pans with Teflon that I use. But when I have some of my friends,
I never pull out a Teflon pan.
So, they don't even know they exist. They are hidden in my cabinet.
So the next time I'm at your house, I better check the pan
to
know whether I'm a friend or not.
Never. I've got friends. Are you kidding? They look and they go, using Teflon? I don't even touch that. I just leave those pans right in there. And I have cast iron. I feel really proud. I've got cast iron in there, which is...
What about cleanup on that, though, Zorba?
Well, when I clean up, I use a Tuffy. That's the name of the little thing that I use. And then I wash it. No, I wash it with soap and water, and sometimes I oil it. Cast iron is great. And frankly, I use it. The only thing I actually use my Teflon pans for are eggs. That's about what I use them for. Mm-hmm. And I use it. I now use it the right way. However, there are people who come to my house that I will never pull it out for. And they are hidden in the back of the cabinets. For them, it's a very funny thing. Thank you so much. Thanks for your call.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, bye-bye. 800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, we welcome a listener in Dublin, Ireland. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, hello, Zorba and Tom. And I'm in Dublin right now, but I'm from Eau Claire. So I'm kind of cheating, but...
that's funny.
It's wonderful to be on the line with you.
Uh-huh.
And my question actually takes us back to the southwest of France, where my wife and I were house-sitting for these people, and before they left, they gave us a mountain of cheese. It was Roquefort and Camembert. It was unbelievable. And being from Wisconsin, loving cheese, we kind of went crazy and went through it in like a week. And after that week, I started to notice that whereas before eating all this cheese, I was, you know, having about 3 to 5 BMs, if you know what I mean, a day, to where I went like 2 weeks with nothing. And then, you know, on and off again for maybe like every 3 days, every 5 days, but it was nothing like it was before. And I know that cheese can block you up, but I was worried about this. And I also was wondering what physiologically is going on when you eat cheese to make you slow down like that.
Well, first of all, you have now seen what one of the advantages of eating cheese is for those people who have loose bowels. They actually will slow things up because cheese tends to be constipating. And I'm not sure exactly what it is in the cheese that actually slows down the gut. Being from Wisconsin and having lots of listeners in the ag department, I'm sure I'm going to get some emails that are being written as we speak about cheese and why cheese causes constipation, but it does. So one of the things you can do is to eat dried fruit, if it's around. Because dried fruit does exactly the opposite. Apricots, pears, prunes, not dried bananas, but even apples will make a difference. And in fact, the apple a day will keep the doctor away. Advice from the 1890s was really to try to get a regular bowel movement, because the theory in 1890 was if you didn't have a bowel movement every day, you would explode. And it was bad. It's not true. I've never seen anyone explode, but that's what you want to do. You want to add some fruit to it. And if you think about the way cheese is traditionally eaten in France, you know, at the end of the meal, it's often fruit and cheese together. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's why they're sort of paired together. And I don't think the French would eat quite as much of that mountain and cheese as you did. You brought your Wisconsin appetites.
We got a little excited, I think.
Into there. Now, I've got a question. So you were house-sitting and had cheese in France. You're in Dublin. Did they leave you a ton of Guinness? Were you in the house?
If only. We did have some. Yep, we did some house sitting here in Ireland too, on the west coast, in County Mayo, which was exciting. Mm-hmm. And we were given some Guinness, but not nearly as much cheese as we were given before in France.
Now, I've got a question for you. So are you guys going around house sitting in various places? Is this a job or a vacation? What is this?
We're on a long vacation because we got married last summer, and then I was accepted to medical school, but we wanted to have some fun before the veil of tears.
The veil of tears.
So I deferred my enrollment for a year. So we've been in Europe for 3 months, and we're actually flying home tomorrow.
But how much fun to house sit? That must be a wonderful experience.
Yeah, it allowed us to stay a lot longer than we would have been able to otherwise, and we got to meet people in ways you wouldn't have otherwise, and we got to take care of donkeys and chickens, and yeah, it's a really good thing to do. I recommend it to anyone.
How neat. Thank you. Thanks, and thanks for sharing that. That sounds like a great thing to do, and good luck with the Veil of Tears.
Thank you. Thank you for your help as well. Yeah.
Take care.
I may have told you this story. A few years ago, my wife and I were vacationing in Paris, sitting at a cafe, having a nice conversation, and the table next door woman looks over and says, "Are you Tom Clark?"
I know you didn't tell me that. You're sitting in Paris.
A listener, obviously, in the States.
Right next to you in the cafe. So, you Tom Clark? That must have just blown you away.
It's something I haven't forgotten. 800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. So, Zorba, some info on stretching before exercise.
Yeah, very interesting information. So this actually comes from an article in the New York Times, and they reviewed a couple of different articles that looked at stretching. So one of the articles came out of the Journal of Strengthening and Conditioning Research. Now, I don't know if that's a good journal or what I call a throwaway journal. Mm-hmm. Do you know what the phrase throwaway journal is?
Anybody can guess. Right. It means it isn't any good.
It isn't any good. Yeah. And what happens is, for many, many years before the net, I used to get like 30 journals in my office every month, and most of them I'd pick them up, look at them, and throw them away. I wouldn't even look at this table of contents, because they were junk journals basically made for advertising. And I have no idea if the Journal of strength and conditioning research as a throwaway journal or not. And it's actually a good study. New York Times reviewed it. I looked at what they did. And basically, they reviewed 104 different studies along with their own data. And it was sobering because what they found is people who stretched before they engaged in competitive competition generally did about 5% poorer.
Poorer,
worse in jumping, worse in lifting, worse in a variety of other things. So that comes into contact with a few other studies that were done in a variety of other journals that looked at the ability of, once again, you go and you stretch and then you try to lift weights. And lo and behold, it turns out the same is true in some other studies. In other words, that if you stretch, you may actually be decreasing your performance. Now, why is that actually happening? Well, and our idea is we're going to warm up our muscles, so we're going to get them going so they're warmed up before we actually compete. But there's an alternative view, and the alternative view is that our muscles are like a rubber band. And you know, when you first stretch a rubber band, you pull it out. When you stretch it the second time, it's not as strong as it is the first time. And basically, you've got the most stretch on that band prior to the event. And when you stretch it, you're actually going to remove some glycogen that's in the muscle, which is fast energy that's stored within the muscle. And you're removing some of the tension that's in the muscle that you actually want to use to do your walking, running, lifting, and so on. And so I think it's fascinating that stretching may not be as good as we think. And these are scientific studies that are looking at it. My own thought is that when I'm done, I don't stretch before I exercise. I stretch after I exercise because then it makes me feel better and I feel better when I'm walking. But I don't stretch before an event. And it may be that if you're going to run or jog or do some lifting, powerlifting, you should look and see whether or not you do better before and better after.
I used to stretch after I exercise, but I hurt myself doing that.
Maybe you're stretching the wrong way.
I'm sure I am.
Maybe you're stretching.
Not anymore because I just stopped doing that.
You stopped exercising.
Well, not quite. I'm kind of wishing that would hurt me too so I wouldn't have to do that either. 800-462-7413. It's toll free. 800-462-7413. And now Zorba, listener with us in Buffalo, New York. Hi.
Hey.
How can we help?
So I had some questions about herniated discs. My husband has a herniated disc, and he's just a really physical person. He runs, he bikes, he swims, and so he's really struggling because he's not able to engage in those activities that he really enjoys so much and that kind of keep him sane. So I was just wondering if you guys had any suggestions for any kind of alternative therapy.
So how long has he had this, the back pain, back problems?
Probably 6 months. A year.
Oh, 6 months. How old is he?
He is 31.
31. Okay, so young guy. So the last thing you want to do is engage in surgery in somebody young if they don't need it. So
putting
that off to the side. And you don't want to have surgery unless you've exhausted all of the conservative therapies. And for back pain, sometimes time is the most important kind of therapy that we have. So if we look at people who have no back pain at all, and we do MRI scans in 30-year-old guys who are healthy and who jog, probably about 5% of them, 3 to 5% of them will have, quote, slip discs somewhere in their back. So in other words, they have a slip disc on the MRI, but they don't have any symptoms at all. So the presence of a slip disc doesn't mean that's causing the pain. That's the problem. We don't have a way of saying the disc is causing the pain and therefore it's there. So looking at acupuncture, exercise, anti-inflammatories, stretching, those things really do make a difference. And then he has to look if he's still engaging in jogging and running. He has to look and see what activities are bothering him. So what is he engaging in right now in terms of activities?
So right now he's really stopped doing any of the physical activities he enjoyed. You know, he's not running, he's not biking, those kinds of things. Those just made the pain worse.
Well, there's a big difference between running and biking. So
Has
he found he can bike but he can't run? Because jogging is totally different than getting on a bike.
He's found both of them to be painful.
Okay, so he found both of them to be uncomfortable. Okay, so I would try acupuncture. That's what I would do. I would go to massage therapy and see whether or not that would work. But there are people who are 30 years old who get microdiscectomies. In other words, there's still an invasive procedure into the back. Nobody likes thinking that someone's going into your spine, but there are procedures where you really do remove the disc that's herniated, and it can make a big difference. I have patients in my practice who who are younger, who have had surgeries done, and they go, this is remarkably different. All of a sudden, I can do things again. So I think if everything else fails, if it were me, I would, after a year, not before a year, I would seriously consider having some disc, and I would look at the minimal disc that I would do it. So let's go to that for a second. Has he seen a neurosurgeon or a back surgeon?
No, he hasn't.
Okay. If he decides to go to someone, the question is, who do you go to? There are orthopedic surgeons, they do back surgery, and there are neurosurgeons, and they do back surgery. And both of them are good. They look at the back kind of differently. They have different ways that they've been trained, but they're both equally good. And if it were me and I were in a town, I would go get two opinions. And I would look at a minimally invasive back surgery. And one way I would go to is I would go to an opinion. I'd ask my doctor, you have two different people. And some docs will say, yeah, I referred it to 2 or 3. Why don't you go to these two people, get an opinion as to what I would do before I'd have my 30-year-old back worked on.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, sure.
Good luck.
Appreciate the call. So if I'm 60... Then I just
why
suffer
finish
for
that?
30 years?
No. I was just saying, a 30-year-old, you have different options than with the 60-year-old. I noticed that you immediately gave me the eye for a 60. Right, you just suffer until you die at 90. It's not what I meant to say.
Before the break, Zorba, let's log into the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and take a quick question from Mark in Fitchburg, Wisconsin, who needs a bit of your sugar-free sagacity. He writes, hi, Dr. Pastor. I have a weak spot for sugar-free peppermint gum. I probably chew way too much of it and consume an ungodly amount of aspartame. I've heard rumors that aspartame poses numerous threats to human health. The internet has a ton of both pro and con websites to sift through. What do you know about aspartame? Are there any conclusive independent findings? Thank you.
You're welcome. Aspartame is the most studied sugar substitute that has ever been around. And before it first came out, it was G.D. Searle, and they made a ton of money. And basically, they're 2 amino acids. That's what they are. I mean, they're amino acids. Aspartame is a protein. That's all it is. They're 2 amino acids put together that are very sweet. You can't take it if you have phenylketonuria because phenylalanine is one of the amino acids. It's safe. But there are a lot of websites that say, no, it's awful. So I think it's safe. I believe in the feds. There's no evidence at all. It's been blamed on everything from hair loss to cancer to autism to political, politics in Washington. They weren't drinking diet soda. They would finally get together and actually make decisions together. it's been blamed on everything. Are you ready? The weather. Everything is blamed on aspartame. And the reality is it's been studied all over the place. There's no evidence it's bad for you. Now, given that, it's your choice. I like choice. I'm not a member of the aspartame or the anti-aspartame lobby. If you want to have a Diet Coke, have a Diet Coke. If you don't want to have aspartame, then you get Coke Zero, which I think has Splenda in it, which is a different artificial sweetener. Or if you want to have the calories, just have plain old regular sugar, which causes diabetes and heart disease in large amounts. It makes us obese. So the reality is, aspartame, I think, is okay. And every time I say it's okay, I get a slew of letters that go, how could you possibly say okay, Dr. Pastor? You are an awful person because you're saying it's okay. I get nasty letters sometimes on the fact that I'm there. You'd think I don't stock in the company,
You're not an awful person.
That's it. I'm not an awful person. That's my answer to aspartame.
If you have the gumption to voice your vices,
I love it.
Send your concerns in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org. My mind is working a little slowly because I've been eating aspartame. So it's not quite with it.
No aspartame in our recipe. That's coming up next. Lots more of your questions, some interesting research to talk about, our medical myth buster. Lots of great reasons for you to stick with us here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. More of your calls coming up at 1-800-462-7413. But first, Zorba, recipe time, herb and almond crackers.
Crackers, that's right. When do you think about making crackers? When do you think about making crackers?
I didn't know you could. I thought you had to
buy them from Nabisco. That's right. Your idea of making crackers is how much is that box?
Yeah.
How much is that box? Well, basically, think about it. Crackers have a history. The National Biscuit Company started making crackers, I don't know, in about 1910, and they became a hit because they were hard to make at home because you had ovens that you really couldn't get hot enough and people couldn't make them.
Yeah. So I'm not way off the wall. I mean, it isn't a common thing.
Well,
to make
you're
crackers.
1910, and this is the year 2013.
It still isn't common. When's the last time you made crackers?
Never. I've never made a cracker. That's right. That's right.
Point made.
Point made. Okay. You think I'm just joshing?
We're going to make them now, though.
Point made. Okay. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. 1 cup of blanched almond flour.
Cup of blanched almond flour.
Okay, so where would you find blanched almond flour if you wanted to make this recipe?
In the grocery store.
That's right. You might have to go to a specialty grocery store because they don't have it in every grocery store. Let me tell you, Bill's Foods in Oregon, Wisconsin does not have blanched almond flour.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have that. So you'd have to go to
a
major grocery store. You call them up and ask around before you go look for it. Half a teaspoon of salt, preferably sea salt or kosher salt.
Half a little tea salt.
Mm-hmm. Sea salt or kosher salt. You want it to be that chunky salt. Mm-hmm. And you want the sea salt to be preferably, you put it out of a shaker or you have it in just like a pepper grinder or salt grinder. Mm-hmm. You could use Tibetan pink salt on this too. It would look very nice.
It's a
salt. It's mined in Tibet. And I don't know what the trace mineral is, but it's actually pink. Mm-hmm. It's a slight pink
Let me jump in on this because the sea salt on the shelf at the grocery store, some of it says warning or something. Mm-hmm. This salt does not contain iodine, which is necessary for your health.
Well,
all sea salt not have iodine?
Well, salt doesn't have iodine. We put it in.
Sea salt
doesn't have iodine. Doesn't have significant.
And we don't put it in.
No. Now, it turned out that before we iodized salt, there was a lot of goiter, and the Midwest was the goiter belt. My grandmother had her goiter removed. My aunt Belle had her goiter removed, and my cousin Margie had a goiter removed, and that was from lack of iodine. But then iodized salt entered into the
used that sea salt without iodine,
you're still
the time.
Because we eat more fish, and iodized salt is on the whole. I say if you're going to have a salt shaker on the table, make sure it's iodized salt. But you don't have to have it in everything. You don't need it in these crackers. You don't need it. But they're telling you this doesn't have iodized salt, so you know that.
Yeah.
And you're not giving it to your family assuming that it will have iodized.
Okay, moving right along.
But that's a good point. Teaspoon of garlic, finely chopped.
Little tea garlic, finely chopped.
A teaspoon of dried thyme.
A little tea dried thyme.
Why do you think it's T-H-Y-M-E and we pronounce it thyme? And it's like, where's the H in this?
Yeah.
Why don't we pronounce that?
How many English words in your dictionary?
But somehow thyme is like, because I lived in Canada for a year, and you know how they pronounce it?
Thyme?
No, thyme. Same thing. I'm sorry.
That was unfair.
I just want to make sure you're awake.
All right.
Awake today. 1/2 tablespoon of extra virgin olive oil.
Half a big tea olive oil.
And 2 tablespoons cold water.
Sorry,
I was being unfair. I apologize.
That's all right.
From the bottom of my heart, I apologize.
On my copy of the recipe, it says a sprig of rosemary. I don't know if we mentioned that.
I don't think we did.
Yeah.
So a sprig of rosemary.
Okay.
But now you have. Now you have.
Yeah.
You're keeping me on track. Okay. Preheat the oven to 350 degrees. Then take, in a food processor, you want to pulse the almond flour, salt, garlic, and herbs together. So it's all going to be pulsed together. Whisk in the olive oil, so take it out, whisk it in, and water together in a bowl. So you're going to whisk the olive oil and water separately in the bowl, and then you're going to add it to the food processor and pulse it until it's a lumpy, oily dough. Then roll the dough into a ball, place between 2 sheets of parchment paper, that's the stuff that we actually use to bake, roll it flat with a rolling pin and spread it out until it's as thin as possible. Now that means even thinner than you think. thinner, 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 mm-hmm. thinner, because mm-hmm. a cracker is super mm-hmm. thin. So as thin as you can possibly do. And then you pull off the top piece of parchment paper. You can't do this without parchment paper because you can't do it. Transfer the bottom piece of rolled dough onto a baking sheet, so it's going to be a little bit hard. Transfer it once again. And then use a pizza cutter or a sharp knife to slice the dough into crackers, you know, about 1.5 to 2 inches, and sprinkle them lightly with the coarse salt. Bake them one sheet at a time until crisp. It's about 10 to 15 minutes. Watch it carefully because if you don't, you will find out that they are burned crackers. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot of work mm-hmm. for burned crackers. And the edge is going to be very brown, very kind of quickly on the edge. Remove them, return the rest of the crackers into the baking sheet, and you've got a cracker there. Yeah. And it takes a little while to do this. I've done this with pizza. This particular recipe, it just takes a while to learn how thin it has to be. It's really mm-hmm. thin. But with the parchment, you're going to be able to transfer it because you're not going to be able to pick it up with your hand. So you're going to take that paper to actually transport it.
So if you'd like a copy of this recipe, take the time to That's get right. to the website.
Oh, excellent. Excellent.
At
ZorbaPastor.org. While you're there, you can look at photos of Tom, photos of me, search the other recipes, download our podcast, have a grand old time at ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, please, you can find us on Facebook and you can even like us, whatever that means, on Facebook.
1-800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, back to the phones we go. A listener with us in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, it's kind of a convoluted question. I'm going to try to make it as clear as possible. I recently moved here and set up with a new OB-GYN. And going through all the family history, she suggested that I look into some genetic testing for possible breast cancer and colon cancer, just because there's a lot of cancer on my mom's side of the family, specifically breast cancer, uterine cancer, and colon cancer. I never really heard about this before, so it was a little shocking to hear that, you know, we could do this now. And I talked to my family a little bit about it. My mom was very wary about it, but my sister had also received the same advice from her doctor. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering what your opinion, Zorba, was of doing this, perhaps.
Well, first of all, there are a couple things. Let's look at colon cancer. We don't really have a way of determining genetically if you're at high risk for colon cancer. There's some tests, but let's put that off to the side. You know, colon cancer okay. is a common cancer. Breast cancer is too, obviously. And let's talk just about colon cancer. Who had colon cancer in your family?
My grandmother on mother's mother.
Grandmother, but nobody else in the family. So colon cancer, grandmother, it's not a first-degree relative. It's a second-degree relative. Is your risk higher? Maybe slightly higher, but at the age of – the question will be when you're 40 – whether or not you start with a colonoscopy or when you're 50. And by that time, we'll have – there's some other tests that are on the horizon, so you won't need a colonoscopy. You'll have a poop test that will be testing genetically. You're how old now?
28.
28. So I wouldn't worry about that for 12 years. If your mom had it, your dad had it, still you would do it with a colonoscopy. Now, breast cancer, there's the BRCA genes 1 and 2, BRCA1, BRCA2. They do help predict breast cancer. Women who have that are at a significantly higher risk. The tests are expensive. I think they're $2,000 or something. They're very expensive because there was a lot of research that went into actually testing this, and there's some questions about patents involving this. But who had breast cancer in your family?
Again, my grandmother.
Again, so your grandmother had it, but your mom did not.
No, my mom had uterine cancer.
Okay. So your mom had uterine cancer. Uterine cancer is, again, a common cancer. So, you know, you have to think about whether, you know, this is a family history. That's what it is. And cancers do run in families. And you have to decide whether or not you want to have the genetic testing and what that's going to be, you know, what that's going to mean. You don't have a strong history for it because your mom didn't have it. If your mother and her sister and the grandmother had it, well, that would be a strong family history. So sometimes there's overkill. You know, sometimes if you're in a center like Boston, which is where you have major hospitals, major medical schools, there's a lot of testing that's done, and frankly, a lot of testing that's over testing. There is such a thing as over testing. In Madison, Wisconsin, where we have a great university, I work for a group that's not university involved, but I do some teaching at the university. You're much less likely to be tested than in Boston. In Boston, they're just much more sort of test-heavy on doing it. So on the whole, in the Midwest, I don't think you would get the same advice as you get in Boston.
Okay.
That's where it
Why
sits.
Why wouldn't you just do the test?
Well, first of all, what are you going to do with the information from the test if you have it? So are you going to – then you've got to decide what you're going to do with it if you're over-tested. The test doesn't tell. It says you're at somewhat increased risk, but the family history isn't there. So should everyone whose grandmother had colon cancer, mother has uterine tester, have this $2,000 to $4,000 test? Why now? Why when you're 28? So that means everyone should get it. So all of a sudden, we have $2,000 to $4,000 more per woman who's 28 when these cancers are also common cancers?
Yeah.
That's the question. So you've got a point of view of where do you deploy your dollars. Then you run the fact that now you've got another question you have to answer. So I think my own opinion is that this can be overkill. But I have also a very strong opinion that there are individual decisions that a woman or a man makes with their doctor on a very individual basis. And I put it back in the hands of the fact that this is something that you really have to discuss. But if I were sitting there counseling you, I would come down on the I don't think this test is necessary.
And health insurance doesn't cover any of these.
Well, it depends on your insurance plan. Might cover it, it might cover it. And insurance plans are changing with the new health insurance plan over the next few years. So you went to the doctor, and the doctor said, I think you should be genetically tested for this.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. If you came to my office, I would not recommend you get genetically tested. We don't do that. It's also not in the U.S. Public Service Task Force test recommendations. They are very conservative, and they do not recommend the testing for this. So I always go back to where are the authorities and who's recommending this, and is this recommended by which societies? And I personally, if you were in my office, I think it's overkill.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling.
We appreciate the call. Thanks. And time now, Zorba, for another riveting round of rapid fire. Are you ready?
Yes, I am.
First up, John's eager to know the difference between brown and white eggs. Is one better?
Oh, no, it's not. It's a style issue. If you like brown, stick to brown. If you like white, stick to white. White is associated with cleanliness, and that's where it started in the 30s.
Now, on to our grandparents, Bob and Kay, who have a 22-month-old granddaughter with a temperature of 100 degrees. Is that normal?
Well, it all depends on the child. Usually 100 degrees means the child might have an infection or a virus. However, if the child is great and moving around, is 100 degrees all the time, well, maybe that child just has a higher normal. But often it means the child is fighting an infection.
Next up is Dawn, who's wondering if garlic stored in olive oil is as healthy as the fresh stuff.
Of course it is. And then you've got the joy of olive oil, which is so delicious. Good.
Now for one of your favorite topics, Zorba. Beans. Dave in Nicholasville, Kentucky asks, is it true that the more beans you eat, the better your body becomes at digesting them?
I don't think that means anything at all. I think the more beans you eat, the more gas you'll get. But legumes are wonderful.
We move on to Maureen now, Zorba, who's in a bit of a pinch. She wants to know what to do about a pinched nerve in her back.
Well, it all depends. First thing, exercise, massage, do some stretching yourself. Sometimes some anti-inflammatories, and if that fails, well, you might have to go to your doctor and get some other advice.
And we'll wrap this round up with a recent fad. Brenda's wondering if spending time in a dry sauna will benefit her health.
Well, it might. Just ask the Scandinavians and Finns. They've been doing it for years, and they live a long, sweet life in cold, cold weather.
Way to keep up the pace, Zorba, but now you can relax, because that's it for this week's edition of Rapid Fire. Make sure to get your questions in for our next round. Send your email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Some interesting research coming up, more of your calls, and, of course, our medical myth buster, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. But before our next call, some interesting research, Zorba, on music and premature babies.
Right. So premature babies are more and more common in this country. And in fact, about 10%, a little more than 10% of all the babies who are born premature. Hmm. And we do a great job with premature babies. But you can just imagine if you're a premature baby and you're conscious and you're in a unit, you know, a neonatal ICU for a while, and it's got noise and buttons and sounds and a whole bunch of other things that can be very disturbing. And we know that when children, premature children, especially, but any child is disturbed, their heart rate goes up, their oxygen needs go up. It may activate the flight or fright response, even in an infant with adrenaline. And sometimes you want the baby to be calm and soothing. And this particular study was looked at 11 hospitals where they actually played live music. So you can just imagine it was live music in the ICU, which had a very a tempo, just like you would do in a song that you would sing your child, very regular music. We're not talking about a hard rock, but we're talking about, we'll say, melodious Beatles-type music.
Soothing music.
And what they found was that the baby's heart rate was slower. Their oxygen needs didn't seem to be as much. They seemed to be more relaxed, just kind of what you do with a child. You know, when a child is home and the child is upset, you sing to your child and you give soothing sounds to your child. And it's something we may be missing in terms of ICUs, neonatal ICUs with our babies.
But do we know anything about a permanent, lasting effect?
Well, we know that when a child is born, that what happens in the first week, 2 weeks, month, 2 months, 6 months, 10 months is extremely important to the development of the brain. We know that. And we know that a child is born in loving circumstances that are touched and held do better. And that's why in neonatal units, they used to put babies aside and not touch them very much. And then 20 years ago, 30 years ago, they realized they were doing the wrong thing. There was a whole bunch of animal research by Harry Harlow, among others, that showed that warmth and touch were important to infants. Well, maybe sound is important. Because remember, infants cannot see in the womb. Their eyes, they can see, but it's black. It's pitch black. However, they can hear sounds. They can hear mother sounds, father sounds, noise and music. And so they've developed their acoustic, you know, their acoustic abilities.
And we're focusing on premature here because they're in the hospital.
Well, and they have more problems when they get out of the hospital. Premature babies, we know, are at risk for a whole bunch of different things and anything we can do. So this may be one aspect of what we should be doing with preemies. It may be it's not just warmth, it's not just touching, it's not just the Western medical things that we do to interact with them, but it may also be music, soothing music that may be good for them.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Wichita, Kansas. Hi.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Dr. Zorba. I have a question about vaccines. Seems like you get information pretty extreme on both sides, and I was kind of hoping to get some middle ground here. I'm about to be a first-time father, and I was just wondering, what are the necessary vaccines, and more so, can you prolong them rather than going off the schedule of getting, you know, 3, 4, or 5 at a time? Can you do more of a one at a time?
Oh, sure. I've done a lot of research on vaccines, but here's what has happened over the last years. We've increased the number of vaccines, and it has made a huge difference in how healthy babies are. So when I first started practice, we still used to see bacterial meningitis in young children. I had maybe 2 cases or 3 cases. I haven't seen it in years because we've got the hip vaccine, Haemophilus influenza, which is a bacterial infection. We don't see it anymore. And we vaccinate for influenza because influenza turns out to affect young children the same way. And so now kids come in and they get a whole bunch of vaccines at the same time. The good news of that, and like you said, the idea of prolonging it, you would think is better, but it turns out it's not. And I'll explain why in two steps. First of all, it turns out when your body mounts an immune response to the vaccine, if there are two vaccines going in at the same time, it actually has a more robust response to each one. It's sort of like you're priming the system. So we often have four vaccines that we're giving at the same time. If you give it over time, then you got to bring your baby in, side effects. The side effects are four different times, four different vaccines. It might seem like a good idea because they're not poked at much, but I don't think it is a good idea. I think it's better to just follow the schedule. Now, I've looked at the schedule, and I've looked at the change in the number of healthy babies that we have, and I am now on board for vaccines. Now, there are people who are against vaccines. They go, it causes autism. It does not cause autism. The data is there. And the reason why the data is there is that a number of vaccines were stopped in a number of countries. In England, they stopped immunizing for measles for a while because they thought it caused autism. I can't remember if it was in Japan they stopped pertussis because they thought it caused autism. Whenever they stopped the vaccines, they saw a rise in the disease, and they did not find a drop in autism. And back to England, I don't think it was measles. I think it turned out to be the pertussis that they stopped. But so, you know, I have four kids. I had them immunized. I think I just kind of bite the bullet for the kids and give them Tylenol when they're doing it. They're not any sicker. I haven't seen parents, because the vaccines are better, to say they're any sicker when you give them three or four. It just hurts more at that moment.
And what about vaccines for the parents, for me and my wife? What do you recommend for that?
Well, first of all, one of the vaccines I think that's important when you have a newborn is that if you are at risk for influenza during the season, and this season, of course, the flu vaccine was not good at all, you have to decide if you're going to get the influenza vaccine. For adults, one of the things that the feds are now recommending is the DTaP, DT, which means acellular pertussis and tetanus. And the reason is because adults are now getting pertussis. And Wisconsin happened to be one of the places where there have been outbreaks of pertussis, whooping cough. And whooping cough, the Chinese name for whooping cough is the 100-day cough. It's just an awful, awful cough where it's hard to catch your breath, and you can give it to kids. So I think getting immunized yourself for the DTaP vaccine is there. Very important, the polio vaccine. We no longer give the oral vaccine because there were cases of polio from the oral vaccine, and there's no polio around in the country. So you want to get, of course, the Salk vaccine, which is the shot vaccine. But for adults, it's really getting the DTaP vaccine. And then, of course, making sure you love your child and you do all those good fun things as an adult. You must be very excited about this baby.
Oh, absolutely thrilled.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful. Well, babies change lives, so congratulations.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for the call at 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Well, Zorba, time once again now for our medical myth buster. Today we take one from Francine in Lake Zurich, Illinois, who needs you to skim over some questionable claims. She writes, "Dear Doc, love your show and the medical myth busters. Now, I have one for you to check out. I recently heard that you shouldn't drink skim milk that comes in plastic jugs. Supposedly, the vitamin D added to the skim milk attaches to the plastic container because the milk doesn't have enough fat to hold the vitamin D. This means you don't get enough vitamin D if you only drink skim milk from plastic jugs. Sounds like hooey to me, but I can't find any information online. Is this just another myth?"
It's hooey. That's exactly it. It turns out the vitamin D in vitamin D milk, which is tested, is connected to the protein in the milk. And when you look at skim milk, you're removing all the fat. And so basically it's the protein that really is exactly the same. So you're going to get vitamin D. It's not in the plastic container. But I want to talk a little bit about skim milk for a second, because I dislike skim milk. I don't like skim milk. 1% is fine, but skim milk just doesn't taste right to me. And I just want to, you know, there was a recent study that looked at babies who were fed skim milk on 1% versus babies who were fed 2% in whole milk. And it turned out that the ones who were fed skim milk on 1% were more likely to be obese at 2 years and at 4 years than the babies who were fed 1% and 2%.
Now, that just doesn't make any sense. It's certainly counterintuitive.
Counterintuitive, and it may be that these children, you know, who were basically fed, you know, after 1 year of age.
Maybe they had lust for
other foods.
Milk.
And maybe they had lust for fat, and maybe they got the calories somewhere else. Huh. So I've decided I never recommend skim milk to my patients anymore at all. I say if you're going to drink milk, drink 1%, limit it, but have something that really tastes good. And so that brings up the fact that vitamin D is in milk, but why are you drinking skim? Maybe you ought to go to 1%.
Well, heard a vitamin claim you'd like to deny? Just send it along. Send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
That toll-free number again, 800-462-7413. And Zorba Fitchburg, Wisconsin listener is with us now. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
We appreciate it. How can we help?
Well, my question is about the Mediterranean diet. Mm-hmm. I read the article in the newspaper that you wrote, and it sounds like a very solid diet. And the research that you also cited sounded very, very good. And I do follow parts of it, but one of the questions I had is I couldn't figure out what to have for breakfast. Mm-hmm. I didn't see grains, and I didn't see, like, eggs or cheese or things like that. So I wondered if you could comment and if you're following the Mediterranean diet, what kind of breakfast you would have?
You know, it's interesting because I never thought about that until now. I never thought about the fact that when we talk about a Mediterranean diet, we're not really talking about who eats olive oil and fish for breakfast for breakfast in the morning. What do you have for breakfast, Tom?
You know, cereal and juice.
I
think the Mediterranean area, they sleep in.
Can they sleep in? You know, Tom's right. They don't have breakfast. They have lunch, dinner, and then they stay up until the wee hours of night and they sleep in. I like that, Tom. I'm going to use that next time. I'm taking that joke. You'll get credit.
That's all right. It's yours.
You know, what I think is that when we're looking at it, we look at a breakfast that is healthful. Mm-hmm. So, first of all, I'm not against eggs at all. I think that an egg a day is just fine. And so an egg every 2 days, I think that we've gone kablooey about eggs. If our cholesterol is highly elevated, I believe in statin drugs and they're useful. And there's some recent studies that show that an egg or two a day isn't bad. If you like eggs and you want to stay away from the yolk that has the cholesterol, do it. Or you have one egg yolk with one egg white, you can have a double egg and still have that taste. And there's lutein, by the way, in the egg yolk. And since we've been removing eggs from people's diets, we've had an increase in macular degeneration, and some people think it's due to the lack of lutein in the diet, and egg yolk turns out to be a dynamite source of lutein. So I just mentioned that because there's some controversial stuff here. But getting back to what I think is a healthy breakfast, I think cereal is great, whole grain cereal. It's the way to get your fiber. So you pick a cereal or cereals, because I like a variety that you like. Oatmeal is wonderful, of course. And then I think it's a good time to have one or two servings of fruit. So maybe put a banana in it. Have a juice glass of juice. A juice glass is 4 to 6 ounces. It's not 12 to 15 ounces. Mm-hmm. That's the main thing. Then we get too many calories from it. Or have another piece of fruit like an orange. I put 1% in my cereal because I think that's about all right. I may have a piece of toast with maybe a little jam or a little butter. I don't use margarine on it. I like butter. And then I have coffee. I think that's a dynamite diet. And frankly, if you look at what they eat, I've traveled through the Mediterranean area a lot. And they have moderate breakfast. They'll have coffee and they'll often have a piece of toast. In Northern Europe, they'll have a more robust breakfast with cereal. But that's what it is. But I like the point because when I visualize a Mediterranean diet, I don't visualize them eating anything. And maybe that's because I picture them up late at night sitting around talking, playing cards and discussing the latest politics. That's very funny. Did I answer your question? I'm sorry. I'm stuck in Tom's sphere. Of they sleep in.
No, you certainly did. That's what actually I was hoping you would say. And so That's all good.
Yeah, I think that's really good. And then there's one other thing you should do. If you're in Spain, what they have for breakfast is they have this little thing. It's like a Mexican, not chorizo. That's a sausage. It's like the little Mexican donuts. But it's a sort of a fried dough that they dip into really good hot chocolate. Oh. And if I lived in Spain, I would have that with a demi-tasse of espresso every morning. And it might not be the best thing for my body, but it would be the best thing for my heart.
Sounds good to me, too.
Thanks for calling.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
And before we head out, Zorba, it's time for a word from a different set of police than we're used to. The math police.
Oh, math. Oh, I love it.
Craig.
That was always my strong suit, math.
Craig in Wauwatosa, me too. Craig in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, is concerned about some calculations you made on a recent program. He writes, recently, you compared the amount of calories in a 500-calorie Subway tuna salad sandwich with the amount of calories in your 250-calorie pork chop sandwich. Mm-hmm. You said the tuna salad sandwich has 50% more calories.
Right. Sorry,
wrong.
Yeah, wrong.
The
right.
tuna salad sandwich has 100%
right.
more
right.
calories. You use the pork right. chop sandwich on the basis for comparison. Therefore, the denominator
That's
is 250
right.
calories. The
That's
difference
right.
is the numerator.
Right.
I know you know that. That's called a slip of the tongue.
My math teacher, Mrs. Kahn, who was my seventh grade math teacher, who I always liked. She was much better than my regular teacher, Miss Schutte, who never liked me at all. But my math teacher, Mrs. Kahn, always gave me kudos. I'm sure she would look at it right now. She'd smile and she'd say, you did it again.
And Craig goes on, Zorba, despite your errors, I enjoy your show very much.
Very nice. Thank you, Craig. I'll take your advice. I'll be better next time.
Mm-hmm. And if you have a disagreement with the doc, you can just email us at
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org. And remember, you can find us on Facebook.
And you can, of course, call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. This show was produced by Gabrielle Pedriani. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich, and our technical director is Brad Colburn. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0504Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.